Good afternoon, everyone. I sure did enjoy the music. And during the song, just when we were singing, Bill said it sounded really well, and it did, right over there. Where all those professionals sit, so right there, you could tell. And Jim, I don't know why you didn't have a song today, but haven't heard Jim sing in a long time. But he sings really, really well too. I think Bill's kind of stolen a little bit of my topic today, so you might be hearing some of the same themes. We had a good Passover at our home with two other people. We saw got a call, and on one night, I can't remember what night we got the phone call on, but Jennings Pinkerman was living in Huntington, so he joined us at Passover. You all remember Morgan and Brenda. Mm-hmm. And we had a small gathering at our home for the night we much remembered last night. Well, God has given special days and appointments and observances so that His followers might remember and learn specific lessons. He says this is my body which is broken for you. Do this in remembrance of me. So we keep these appointments, these moads, every year on an annual basis so that we can remember something. It also says in the Bible, this cup is the new covenant in my blood. This do as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. So every year, God wants to jog our memory so that we recall something. Because if we didn't do this, we would forget. And one more says, so this day shall be to you a memorial, and you shall keep it as a feast to the Lord throughout your generations. You shall keep it as a feast by an everlasting ordinance. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall remove leaven from your houses, for whoever eats leavened bread from the first day until the seventh day, that person shall be cut off from Israel. So it's a memorial. So we have this observance which we do. It seems kind of strange in some ways in our modern society, but it's kind of fun too, to look for leaven and sit there and ponder such major questions such as, the soup has leaven in it. Do I have to get rid of the soup? And so each family will make those choices on their own. Some will say, well, soup's not bread, but soup has leaven in it. So what do you do? So each family makes those choices, and there's some interesting things which we do during these 7 days. But besides memorials and symbols, the Bible also provides examples of people's lives. They provide us examples on how to live and how not to live. And unfortunately for Israel, but fortunately for us, there's an example in the Bible concerning Israel, because much of Israel's experience, much of Israel's history that is recorded for us is how not to live. So if you turn with me to 1 Corinthians 10, we'll see what God has to say, what the Apostle Paul had to say about Israel and their history. 1 Corinthians 10 verse 1 says, "For I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea. And all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea." So the children of Israel, as they walked through the Red Sea, how high were the waters on side? I'm not sure. I love that old picture that I used to see in a book that I had that had the wall of water, the children of Israel walking through, and the artist even put fish and wildlife in the picture. That kind of brings alive. So that was kind of like a baptism for them. And they all ate the same spiritual food. And they all drank the same spiritual drink. For they were drinking from a spiritual rock which followed them, and that rock was Christ. Well, think about that. They had the cloud of fire and the cloud during the day, the pillar of fire and the cloud during the day. They had a rock behind them that was Christ. So we might say that they were totally encompassed by God. They were totally encompassed by Jesus Christ. And it goes on in verse 5. Even though they were totally encompassed, it says, nevertheless, That's never a good statement in the Bible. Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not well pleased. For they were laid low in the wilderness. Now these things happened as examples for us, that we should not crave evil things as they also craved. And do not be idolaters as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and play, and stood up to play. Nor let us act immorally as some of them did. And 23,000 fell in one day. Nor let us try the Lord as some of them did, and were destroyed by the serpents. Nor grumble as some of them did, and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now these things happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed, lest he fall. So we have this example for us, and it's an example of not to follow. And those examples are often good for us, because we want to know what to do, we want to know what not to do. But think about it. They had the pillar of fire and the pillar of cloud by day. They had the rock of Jesus Christ behind them, and yet they could not follow. They did not do what was right. So today what I'd like to just talk about then is to remind us as Christians that to please Him, we need an unwavering commitment to Jesus Christ. So I want to talk about, as Christians, we need an unwavering commitment to Christ to please Him. We go back to Exodus 1 to remind ourselves what kind of state was Israel in. What was their life like before Exodus 1? What was their life like before God got involved with them? In verse 8 it says, "And a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to the people, 'Behold, the people of the sons of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply in the event of war. They also join themselves to those who hate us and fight against us and depart from the land.' So they appointed taskmasters over them to afflict them with hard labor, and they built for Pharaoh storage cities, pit them in Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more the people multiplied, and the more that they spread out, so that they were in dread of the sons of Israel. And the Egyptians compelled the sons of Israel to labor rigorously, and they made their lives bitter with hard labor in mortar and bricks, and all kinds of labor in the field, all their labors which they rigorously imposed upon them." Think about that. They are having a rough time. They were held captive in a foreign country, and their captors were, their job was to make life harder and harder and harder on them. In verse 15, "Then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Sapphira, I guess, and the other was named Pua. And he said, 'When you are helping the Hebrew women to give birth and see them upon the birth stool, if it is a son, then you shall put them to death. But if it is a daughter, then she shall live.'" So not only are we having hard labor and making life bitter for them, we're having genocide, where the Egyptians want to eliminate as many of the Israelites as possible. Or let's say the excess Israelites. In verse 17, "But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt had commanded them, but let the boys live. And the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, 'Why have you done this thing? And let the boys live.' And the midwives said to Pharaoh, 'Because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and they give birth before the midwife can get to them.' So God was good to the midwives. The people multiplied and became very mighty. And it came about, because the midwives feared God, that he established households for them. Then Pharaoh commanded all of his people, saying, 'Every son who is born, you are to cast in the Nile, and every daughter you are to keep alive.'" You know, this was tough times for the children of Israel. Now, if you had the chance to escape, and you were offered that chance, and someone said, "This is what, you know, you're living here, and I'm going to take you over here, and we're going to make life better for you. You know, it's got to get better from where you are. You know, wouldn't you want to listen? Wouldn't you want to hear out this person say, yeah, now what do I have to do? Because life is tough over here, bitter and rigorous. And if I listen to your directions, I can follow you and get out. You know, you would think people would want to do that. If we go over to Exodus 2, verse 23 to 25, I'm going to read this out of the Bible in basic English. But it says, now after a long time, the king of Egypt came to his end, and the children of Israel were crying in their grief under the weight of their work, and their cry for help came to the ears of God. At the sound of their weeping, the agreement which God had made with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob came to his mind, and God's eyes were turned to the children of Israel, and he gave them the knowledge of himself. Or mine says, verse 25, and God saw the sons of Israel and took notice of them. You know, I see you down there. I remember my agreement. And I'm going to free you from this bitterness. I'm going to free you from this rigorous work. So God has a plan. If we go, we know how it works. God sends Moses and Aaron to talk to Pharaoh, and Pharaoh's given several chances to let the children of Israel go out and worship, and Pharaoh keeps saying no, no, no. So there are ten plagues. There are 10 plagues, and so finally we get to Exodus 12, where the instruction of the Passover is given. Now the Lord said to Moses and Aaron in the land, is verse 1, this month shall be the beginning of months for you. It shall be the first month of the year to you. Speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying, on the 10th of this month, they are each one of you to take a lamb for themselves, according to four forefathers' households, a lamb for each household. Now if the household is too small for a lamb, then he and his neighbor nearest to his house are to take one according to the number of the persons in them. According to what each man should eat, you are to divide the lamb. Your lamb shall be unblemished, male, a year old. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats. You shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month. Then the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel is to kill it at twilight. Moreover, they shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts on the lintel of the houses in which they are to eat. So the instructions are, is to get that lamb, to kill it, eat it, divide it up. And if you want to be saved, take that blood and put it on the lintel. So swipe it here, swipe it there on the doorposts. And so that when Jesus passed over, that house would be spared. Great. You do that. I would. You know, that seems pretty easy. So they do that. The firstborn are killed. We know that the Egyptians are very, very mad. And Pharaoh wants them out. Get out of here. Leave. So we go down to chapter 13, beginning in verse 17. And it says, now it came about when Pharaoh had let the people go, that God did not lead them by the way the land of the Philistines, even though it was near. For God said, lest the people change their minds when they see war and they return to Egypt. So we have a little problem arising here at the very beginning. God does not take them the shortest way out. He doesn't take them the quickest way out. He takes them a different path. So, verse 18, hence God led the people around by the way of the wilderness to the Red Sea. And the sons of Israel went up in martial array from the land of Egypt. And Moses took the bones of Joseph with him. He had made the sons of Israel solemnly swear, saying, God shall surely take care of you. You shall carry my bones with you. Then they set out from Succoth and camped in Etham on the edge of the wilderness. And the Lord was going before them in a pillar of cloud by day to lead them on the way, and a pillar of fire by night to give them light that they might travel by day and night. He did not take away the pillar of cloud by day nor the pillar of fire by night from before the people. The point is, It was God leading them. What the children of Israel had to do to get out of this bitterness, to get out of this slavery, was to follow and to be committed. No matter which way the direction went, whatever the way the route was, to get out of that slavery, they had to follow. Now, verse 14, things start to get troublesome. Chapter 14, verse 3. For Pharaoh will say of the sons of Israel, they're wandering aimlessly in the land. Thus I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will chase after them. And I will be honored through Pharaoh and all his army, and the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord, and they did so. And when the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, Pharaoh and his servants had a change of heart toward the people, and they said, what is this we've done that we've let Israel go from serving us? So Pharaoh is double-minded here. He wants to get rid of them, but all of a sudden he's thinking, man, we're going to lose our brickmakers. We need those people back here. Go and get them. Don't let them leave now. So Pharaoh mounts his army, and now they're going after. And verse 6, so he made his chariot ready and took his people with him. He took 600 select chariots and all the other chariots of Egypt with officers over all them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And he chased after the sons of Israel as the sons of Israel were going out boldly. Then the Egyptians chased after them with all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen, and his army, and they overtook them, camping by the sea, beside whatever that is, in front of whatever that is. But here is the important part of this. Verse 10, and Pharaoh drew near. The sons of Israel looked, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them. Following God sometimes is what? He doesn't always take us the direct route, and he doesn't always do it in the quickest of manner either. You know, sometimes we like to be pulled out of our trials, and God leaves us in those trials, and we still have to follow. You know, here are the children of Israel. They're looking, they're waiting for deliverance, and they're looking at Moses, probably have their hands on their hips, and they're thinking, hey man, and maybe even pointing their fingers at him. Man, you said that you want to get us out of here. And you've just got us in more trouble. What's with you? It goes on. The Egyptians were marching after them, and they became very frightened. So the sons of Israel cried out to the Lord. And they said to Moses, is it because there were no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us in this way, bringing us out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we spoke to you in Egypt, saying, leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in this wilderness. You know, it looked bad. It looked frightening. It looked like they weren't going to be delivered, that they were being taken to their death. Now, if we go to Exodus 14, then I'm gonna skip down to verse 20. I think it's 26 here, and it goes on. It shows that the deliverance. Then it says, then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea by the waters, may come back over the Egyptians, over their chariots and their horsemen. So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea. And the sea returned to its normal state at daybreak, while the Egyptians were fleeing right into it. And then the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. And the waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen, even Pharaoh's entire army that had gone into the sea after them. Not even one of them remained. But the sons of Israel walked on dry land through the midst of the sea, and the waters were like a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. Thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians, and the Egyptians saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. And when Israel saw the great power which the Lord had used against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and his servant Moses. You would think at that time, from that time forward, that there would never be any doubt, that everything that God said, it would be yes, sir. anything that God spoke to Moses and everything he said, it would be, how fast do we go? Which route do we take? How long shall we wait? You know, what shall we do? But in reality, that's not what happened. We go to just quickly over to Exodus 15, beginning in verse 20-22. So all this has happened. They've come through the Red Sea. They just sang a great song praising God. And in verse 22, then Moses led Israel from the Red Sea, and they went out into the wilderness of Shur. And they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. Now you think at this point they would begin saying, we're sure God is going to deliver us. We're sure that water is going to come before any of us get, you know, die of thirst. We're sure that God is going to make sure that our thirst is taken away, because we saw what He just did. But no, in verse 23, when they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore it was named Marah. So the people grumbled at Moses, saying, what shall we drink? And he cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree, and he threw it in the waters, and the waters became sweet. There he made for them a statute and a regulation, and there he tested them. And he said, if you will give earnest heed to the voice of the Lord your God, and do what's right in his sight, and give ear to his commandments, and keep all statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you which I put on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord your healer. Okay. Great. We agree to that. But we just go over to Exodus 16, and we read, we could read all of that entire chapter. And what Israel was looking for, what? Food now. They were looking for food, and they were grumbling again. We could read Exodus 17, where they're grumbling about thirst once again. We could go to Numbers 20, verses 2-13, and 21:4-5, and Israel is still murmuring. You know, how do we react when God takes us to places where we think that we shouldn't go? To places where we think we shouldn't be. When the route is not the most convenient, and when we don't have the patience to wait. Well, what was Israel's final outcome? Let's go to Numbers 14. Israel tested God again, that they would not follow. This is when Caleb and Joshua and some other spies went over to spy the land. And Caleb and Joshua were the only ones who came back with a good report. And the other ones cast doubt on what God's plan was. So God was very upset. In Numbers 14, I'll just read you the conclusion of the story in verse 27. It says, how long shall I bear with this evil congregation who are grumbling against me? I've heard the complaints of the sons of Israel which they are making against me. Say to them, as I live, says the Lord, just as you have spoken in my hearing, so I will surely do to you. Your corpses shall fall in this wilderness, even all your numbered men, according to your complete number, from 20 years old and upward, who have grumbled against me. Meaning, there's going to be those 20 years old and above, even those of the military, are going to die. You're not going into the promised land. They didn't believe. They didn't want to follow. And verse 30 says, surely you shall not come into the land in which I swore to settle you, except Caleb the son of Jephunneh and Joshua the son of Nun. Your children, however, whom you said would become a prey, I will bring them in, and they shall know the land which you have rejected. But as for you, your corpses shall fall in this wilderness. You know, true followers of God, true followers of Christ, must be fervently committed. This is a terrible story, a terrible example. But did you know that Jesus did not have true committed followers? I mean, a large number. He only had a small number of true and committed followers himself. Let's turn to John 6. Beginning in verse 1. Jesus had crowds. Jesus had a lot of people out in the audience, but how many of these people were actually committed followers? And after these things, in John 6, verse 1, Jesus went away to the other side of the sea. And a great multitude, yes, he had a great audience. A great multitude was following him because they were seeing the signs which he was performing on those who were sick. They were only following him because they wanted to see a miracle. They wanted to see what he was going to do next. But many of these people, in fact most of them, were not committed followers. In verse 3, and Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat with the disciples. Now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. And Jesus, therefore, lifting up his eyes and seeing them, a great multitude was coming to him, and said to Philip, where are we to buy bread that these may eat? And this he knew, and this he was saying to test him, for he himself knew what he was intending to do. Of course, Philip said, 200 denarii worth of bread is not sufficient for them, for everyone to receive a little. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, there's a lad here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are these for so many people? And Jesus said, have the people sit down. Now there was much grass in the place, and so the men sat down in number, about 5,000. And Jesus therefore took the loaves, having given thanks, he distributed those who were seated, likewise also the fish, as much as they wanted. Yeah, the people followed, but they were wanting to see a miracle. They were wanting to be fed. They weren't following him for the right reason. The right reason. If we just get in the same chapter, go on over to verse 60, where it says, many therefore of his disciples, when they heard this, said, what did they hear? He was just talking about he was the bread of life, and he came down from heaven. And if you didn't eat of this bread of life, that you had no part with him or the Father. And this was very difficult words for those hearers. And so after they heard that sermon, it says, many, therefore, of his disciples, when they heard this, said, this is a difficult statement. Who can listen to it? But Jesus, conscious that his disciples grumbled at this, said to them, does this cause you to stumble? What then, if you should behold the Son of Man ascending where he was before? It is the Spirit who gives life. The flesh profits nothing. The words I have spoken to you are spirit and life. But there are some of you who do not believe. For Jesus knew at the beginning who they were who did not believe and who it was that they would betray them. And he was saying, for this reason I have said to you that no man can come to me unless it has been granted to him from the Father. And verse 66, as a result of this, many of his disciples withdrew and they were not walking with him anymore. You know, no difference between this group of people and ancient Israel. It was not the large throng that from Israel that went over to the Promised Land. It was not the founding fathers of that nation. They didn't go in. It wasn't the founding fathers of this day that Jesus was actually pleased with. And it wasn't a lot of them. It was just a small amount. So what are the levels of commitment? What are the levels of commitment? I think there's basically 3 which we can talk about. Go back to John 1. That first level is those who are curious seekers. Those who are curious seekers. Now, I've been curious about things. One time Hillary Clinton came into town. She was there stumping for Bill back when he was running for president. She was at Marshall. She was going to stand on the steps and give a speech. where JFK stood years and years ago. You know, it's only 7 blocks down the road. I can walk to it. It's not going to cost me any money. So I'm curious. I'm going to go hear Mrs. Clinton speak. So I went, and I went there because I was curious. And what I learned was that how staged these political activities are, because I saw what went on beforehand, how they are all given flags and they are all positioned to stand behind her. And then as she was talking, there was a guy out in the audience, and when he raised his hand, they all waved their flags. And when he put his hand down, they all put their flags down. So I saw all this going on beforehand and how this was a made for TV event. But the reason why I went, because I was curious. I think at the very beginning, the disciples were curious. That they weren't really into it at the very beginning. We read in John 1, verse 35, it says, "And the next day Jesus was standing with 2 of his disciples, and he looked upon Jesus as he walked, and said, Behold, the Lamb of God. And the 2 disciples heard him speak, and they followed Jesus." Yes, they followed. But was it a deep following yet? "And Jesus turned and beheld them following, and he said to them, What do you seek?" You know, he's asking them, what do you seek? What's your commitment here? What are you looking for? If Hillary Clinton would have saw me out in the audience, I said, "What are you here for? I'm just curious. I'm not going to join the campaign. I don't plan on making phone calls for you. I'm not putting a sign in my yard for you. I'm just curious." Jesus is saying here, "What do you seek? What's your commitment here?" And they said to him, "Rabbi, where are you staying?" You know, a little bit more curious questions. What are you doing here? And he said to them, "Come and you will see." If you want to know, you have to follow. They came therefore, saw where he was staying, and they stayed with him that day, for it was about the 10th hour. One of the 2 who heard him, John speak, said, and follow him, was Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. And he found first his own brother Simon, and said to him, "We have found the Messiah." And he brought him to Jesus. And Jesus looked at him and said, "You are Simon the son of John. You shall be called Cephas," which is translated Peter. And in verse 43, "The next day he purposed to go forth into Galilee, and he found Philip, and Jesus said to him, Follow me." You know, follow me. "Now Philip was from Bethsaida of the city of Andrew and Peter. And Philip found Nathanael and said to him, We found him from Moses in the law. And also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph. And Nathanael said to him, Can any good thing come out of Nazareth?" You know, he's curious here. No, it can't be. Not from Nazareth. I mean, that's like coming from New Boston, or, you know, the people of Portsmouth might say, or the people of Huntington might say, that's like coming from Charleston. It can't be. That arouses curiosity. The Lord, the prophesied Lord, coming from Nazareth, their curiosity gets built up. And Philip said to him, "Come and see." Okay? If you don't believe, be a little bit curious and come and see for yourself. And Jesus said, Nathanael coming to him said, "Behold, an Israelite indeed in whom there is no guile." You know, again, like Nathanael, people follow and join things because they are curious. One time I was in a church organization that had disfellowshipped a major public speaker of that church organization. Well, he was having a service down the road one day, and I was curious. I wanted to hear what he had to say. So I went there one day. I didn't go back. My curiosity was satisfied. But we do things because we are curious. What's the next level of commitment that people have? Well, we can go to John 6, over beginning at verse 67. That next level is we are convinced. We are convinced. And you might say that is the top level. That's where it's all at. And I don't think so. John 6, verse in beginning of verse 66. It says, as a result of this, many of his disciples withdrew. They were not walking with him anymore. And Jesus said, therefore, to the 12, you do not want to go away also, do you? And Simon Peter answered him, Lord, to whom shall we go? You have words of eternal life. And we have believed, and we have come to know you, that you are the Holy One of God. So yes, Peter is above being curious, and he is convinced that Jesus is the Holy One of God. And that is good. And Jesus answered them, did I myself not choose you, the 12? And yet one of you is a devil. You know, but I've heard many sermons from people, from men, who seemed convinced. And I don't know if they're speaking today. In fact, some of them I know don't even believe in God. Bonnie and I have a cookbook, a church cookbook. There's many women who have recipes in there who were faithful coming to church, faithful in trying to be a follower of Christ. And we look at those recipes, she's no longer. Another recipe, she's no longer. She's no longer. She's no longer. And yet there were people who were convinced that what they were doing at that time was the right thing to do. They gave convincing sermons. They appeared to have convincing lives. They had convincing conversations. But again, where are they today? So being convinced, in my mind, is better than being just curious. Obviously it is. But being convinced is not the highest. Let's go to John 21. And John 21 verse 15. And I would say that this is the highest. The highest level of commitment. What is Jesus expecting? He is expecting more than curiosity. He's expecting more than being convinced. But he is expecting people who are willing to be crucified. People who are willing to be crucified. Verse 15. So when they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? Of course, he said, yes, I do. You know that I love you. He said, and of course, Jesus then said, tend my sheep. In verse 16, he said to him again, a second time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Of course, Peter said, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Of course, he said, shepherd my sheep. In verse 17, he said to him a third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Now, Peter's a little bit grieved because he said to him the third time, do you love me? And he said to him, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. And Jesus said to him, tend my sheep. Truly, truly, I say to you, when you were younger, you used to gird yourself and walk wherever you wished. But when you grow old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will gird you and bring you where you do not wish to go. Now this, he said, signifying by what kind of death he would glorify God. And when he had spoken this, he said to him, follow me. Jesus is telling Peter at this point, you're going to have what I expect of my followers to go all the way to the death. Not just to be curious, not just to be convinced, but I want you to walk with me just like I died on the cross. If you have to physically, or even, and then not only just physically, because I don't think all Christians of all time have to do that, but we have to then at least deny ourselves and kill the old man. But Jesus is expecting crucifixion type of following. In verse 20, Peter, turning around, saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following them, the one who also had leaned back on his breast at the supper, and said, Lord, who is the one who betrays you? Peter, therefore, seeing him, said to Jesus, Lord, and what about this man? And Jesus said to him, if I want him to remain until I come, What is that to you? You follow me. Each of us as an individual must be committed to follow him all the way through to crucifixion. Turn with me to Luke 9, beginning in verse 20-23. Again, not every Christian will have to give up their own physical life. But every Christian must make sacrifices. He says, and he was saying to them, if anyone wishes to come after me, let him deny himself. You know, there are things about us that we have to give up. There's things about us that are not Christ-like, and he expects us to lose them, to get rid of them, to crucify them. Let him deny himself and take up the cross daily. Now, not just a once and done thing, but every single day we have to get up and crucify those things that are not of Christ. The leaven in our life. And follow me. For whoever wishes to save his life, meaning those things that shouldn't be in us, but those who want to save those things, save those crumbs of leaven, those who want to save the leaven, he says, shall lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake, he's the one who will save it. For what does a man profit if he gains the whole world and loses or forfeits himself? For whoever is ashamed of me and my words of him, will the Son of Man be ashamed when he comes in his glory and the glory of the Father, of the holy angels. So Jesus is expecting us, our following, our commitment to be on the crucifixion level. One last scripture I'd like to turn to would be in Luke 14, since we're there, and just go over verse 20-25. It says, now great multitudes were going along with him, and he turned and said to them, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother, wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not carry his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. For which one of you, when he wants to build a tower, does not first sit down and calculate the cost to see if he has enough to complete it? In other words, Jesus is saying, you better count the cost. He's expecting somebody to go to the very end. To the very end. Otherwise, when he laid a foundation and is not able to finish it, all who observe it begin to ridicule him, saying, this man began to build and was not able to finish. Or what king, when he sets out to meet another king in the battle, will not first sit down and take counsel whether he's strong enough with 10,000 men to encounter the one coming against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is still far away, he sends a delegation and has terms of peace. So therefore, no one of you can be my disciple who does not give up all his own possessions. You know, Jesus, again, is asking for total commitment to be having the attitude that whatever needs to be crucified, that we will do it. Therefore, salt is good, but even if salt has become tasteless, with what will be seasoned? It's useless, either for the soil or for the manure pile. It's thrown out. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. I won't turn to Galatians 5:24, but it says, all those who are Christ have put to death on the cross the flesh with its passions and its evil desires. So thinking back to Israel, they were curious. You know, was this God through Moses going to save them? They got on board with it. You know, I think that the 10 plagues might have been for Israel's benefit as much as Egypt's benefit, because I was in sales and they send you to all these sales conferences, and what the sales team leader have to do at those sales conferences is sell you on the product first, and once you're sold on the product, you want to leave the door and you want to go out and sell all those things that you have. But I think possibly that the 10 plagues were just for were as much for Israel's benefit as for Egypt's benefit, to get them on board. So were they just curious, or were they convinced? You know what, when God gave the Ten Commandments and all those thunders and lightnings and trumpets and all that kind of stuff, the people said, "Oh, don't speak to us. Whatever you want us to do, we'll do it." And so at that point, maybe Israel was convinced. But just a very few of them, just a very few that met that higher level, Caleb and Joshua. Caleb and Joshua from that first level, from that first group, that were truly committed. Well, the Passover and days of unleavened bread provide many symbols for us as Christians. The days also provide a history of people to show us how and how not to live. That first generation of Israel were not fully committed to God, and most died in the wilderness. God is expecting 100% commitment. Commitment that goes beyond curiosity and being convinced, but commitment that is willing to be crucified. People like it says in Revelation 12, verse 10 through 11, where it talks about a people where it says, "And a great voice in heaven came down to my ears, saying, Now has come salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of His Christ. Because he who says evil against our brothers before our God day and night is forced down. And they overcame him through the blood of the Lamb and the word of their witness. And loving not their lives, they freely gave themselves up to death." Jesus is expecting total commitment.